Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back Jamila Battle.
Well, thank you.
You know, I'm really so grateful always when you are here, taking time off from your own practice to be with us at Your Health. And we got a really interesting show today.
We'll be talking with ophthalmologist Dr. Megan Collins of both the Wilmer Eye Institute and the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins about the ethics of grateful patient fundraising in medicine.
This is really an interesting question in the interface of donations and philanthropy and ethics and the doctor-patient relationship. Looking forward to that conversation. But first, let's dive right in with some research that matters. First one is near and dear to both Jamila and myself. And this is research out of Stanford and Harvard about the number of primary care physicians there are in a population and the health of that population.
Yes, for every 10 additional primary care physicians per 100,000 people in the U.S., there was an associated 51.5-day increase in life expectancy during the decades from 2005 to 2015.
And this compared to, for every 10 increase in specialists per 100,000, was a 19.2-day increase. Now, this is interesting because it certainly shows the value of primary care. You can say it shows the value for specialty care, too. It doesn't say that necessarily primary care was better. They didn't say that, but the life expectancy was a little bit longer. I was a little surprised it was only 51 days. That didn't seem like a lot necessarily, but it's robust because they looked at this nationwide, but they also compared it to some things like quitting smoking, which you say, oh, yeah, absolutely. And then one other thing that I am also really interested in, but it's like the relationship with poverty and how it compares to things to reduce poverty, which would increase life expectancy. And these things actually showed that those were more robust interventions. Mm-hmm. So maybe only a fifth as effective as reducing poverty or two-thirds as effective and maybe three-fifths as effective as quitting smoking. But it shows it is effective. So not surprising to us, right?
Definitely not. But unfortunately, there is a shortfall or a prediction that we will see a shortfall of primary care physicians by 2030. And the research says that it's possibly a lack of healthcare policies aimed at increasing primary care supply. I know even when I was in training, it's also a payment disparity. And when you've got a lot of loans and debt, it's just hard sometimes to make that decision to go into a field that won't pay as much. Not to mention there are higher burnout rates and there's less prestige.
Yeah, so one of the ways, this was published, by the way, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, subspecialty journal, Internal Medicine, a very, very strong journal. And we should point out that this is a problem across the country, but even more so for rural areas. And so policies that you and listeners can think about are, what policies would you advocate for that really do increase primary care physician supply, that really stimulate that supply in more rural areas, whether it's state funding or federal policies or even your own private philanthropic dollars to go to support those kind of endeavors? Because this is where we can make a difference. Let's talk about our next research that matters. Speaking about making a difference, and this is an unusual study, but it's about when there's a resuscitation, in this particular case for children, young children who heart or lungs stop beating, they're really quite sick, they may die in a resuscitation. You hear it in the hospital, they call code blue, code medic. And we know this is a stressful environment. There are a lot of people running into the room. You got one person barking out orders, whoever's the leader of that team, and a lot of different people kind of around to do those orders. And I guess I've never thought about, should I run that code medic, that code IDN, blindfolded?
Well, that is...
You weren't expecting that one to go out, were you? And I know stressful. None of our listeners were either.
But it looks like the blindfolded group actually improved in leadership skills by 11% over the course of 3 resuscitation scenarios versus 5% for non-blindfolded leaders.
Yeah, this was a randomized controlled trial. It's a vigorous research. Mm-hmm. They weren't actually blindfolded when they were conducting these codes. We should say this was like a tool where they were perhaps being given information about what's happening there or simulated code. And I don't think anyone's suggesting that the people in this code should be blindfolded.
No, but they're looking to see because, well, thankfully these are rare events, but I think they're looking to see, okay, maybe there's something to this in the sense that there's improvement in communication. Maybe there is, with this simulation and blindfolding, maybe a novel way to maximize skills gained during simulation since these events don't occur often. And so if we can maximize the skills gained even in simulation, then that would be a good thing when these rare events occur.
Now, Jamil and I are talking this in a very reasoned tone. What's it like, Jamil, in that room when you are called there at 2 a.m. and you had 4 admissions already and you got sick patients on the floor and all of a sudden you're called? What's that like?
Oh, my goodness.
Is it calm and collected?
No, it is not. Everything is flying everywhere, running. People,
your cortisol level is going out the wazoo. You're stressed. You probably have to go to the bathroom. I mean, you know, it's just like, it's difficult. And so anything that can bring a better outcome, and leadership skills are definitely needed there. One of the things I was taught when right before I start running to go up there is actually take my own pulse. They said, you know, in the face of a code, first thing you should do is like, oh, no, not look at the patient, not rush down, do chest. Take your own pulse for 10 seconds because it's this centering. It's this realization that I need to be calm and collected and to maximize my potential. So I think this is in that realm. I like it. I'd be curious to see what their next research, where do they take it? Let's talk about our last research that matters. And it's about something on the other end of the spectrum, but they say what's age got to do with it. So when you think about the health of your heart and how likely you are to maybe have a heart attack in the future, we can talk about the kind of the statistics based upon your age and blood pressure and cholesterol and diabetes and smoking. You could also talk about how the heart may respond to a stress test and whether that is also a predictor of whether or not you're going to really have problems.
And this study was published in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology. And it looks like it was colleagues at the Cleveland Clinic. And it looks like what they did is, based on exercise stress testing, developed this formula to calculate how well people exercise. And this was the physiological age, which they called a BEST score. And essentially, it looked at exercise capacity, heart rate response to exercise, and heart rate recovery.
Yeah, and they called it, it was the age based on exercise stress testing, a BEST.
Yes. A-BEST.
Yeah. A-BEST. Was that a good thing, that if you had a good A-BEST score?
Well, it certainly was. And they looked at 126,356 patients between 91 and 2015. And what they found was that the average participant age was 53.5 years, and 59% were men. And it looks like after about an average follow-up of 8.7 years, 8% had passed. Did they give us the comparison, though?
Well, they said that each of the different components was associated with that kind of A-BEST score, mm-hmm. compared to those who died, compared to those who survived. And it was a better predictor in their models than most of the other things there. So if I take it, I mean, if I do an exercise stress test and they calculate my physiological age as 48 and I'm 58, that's good. That would be really good.
Yes.
If, however, they do it and they say my age is 68 and I'm 58, I better go into that gym and start working here. And so I like it because it gives you some idea, and it's a validated that really makes intuitive mm-hmm. sense. How I respond to measurements of exercise really predicted. I like it. I'm going to look into it. Maybe when I come back, I'll tell you, or maybe I won't tell you what my physiological age is.
Well, I think it motivates people, too, if you've got a number that I am going to get in the gym if my physiological age is older than my chronological age.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with ophthalmologist Dr. Megan Collins of the Wilmer Eye Institute and Bioethics at Johns Hopkins about the ethics of grateful patient fundraising in medicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Emily Hanna. Today on Conversations, Emily, we have the great privilege of talking with ophthalmologist Dr. Megan Collins of both the Wilmer Eye Institute and Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins about the ethics of grateful patient fundraising in medicine. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Collins.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
This is such an important issue and one that's near and dear to me, because it really cuts across every patient encounter potentially in all of medicine. And before we dive into what I think is a really important issue and one that you've raised in an important article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, tell us how you got interested both in healthcare and ophthalmology and ultimately in ethics.
Wow, how much time do you have today?
You take what you need.
Yeah, okay. Well, I would actually say my route to medicine came through ethics in a somewhat circuitous fashion. When I was in college, it was a time where the Second and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals were listening to arguments about whether there was a right to die in the Constitution. And I became very interested in end-of-life issues and ethics. And that led me to take a medical ethics course, which led me to be very interested in medicine. So I ended up going to medical school and doing a clinical ethics fellowship as well. And here I am many years later as a pediatric ophthalmologist and a bioethicist.
Wow, that's a great circle. And I imagine taking care of children and taking care of children who you help really fix really serious diseases that may impair vision does create situations where family members are pretty grateful. I would be.
Taking care of kids is fun, and you're absolutely right. I think vision issues can be particularly stressful for parents and children, and certainly it's a very rewarding specialty to be in because given that fortunately a lot of kids are healthy and can have very good outcomes from things like strabismus surgery or cataract surgery, you do end up with a large number of patients who are able to benefit from their care.
That's great.
Now, you recently wrote about grateful patient fundraising in JAMA. What exactly do you mean by grateful patient fundraising?
So it's a broad category. It's a great question. And depending on where you look in the literature, there are a lot of different names for this. But essentially, this means financial donations from patients to either physicians or their healthcare organizations based on the fact that they had a positive patient experience. They were grateful. They wanted to give back in some way to express their appreciation and their, you know, usually sort of some underlying interest in some type of disease or some type of new intervention that they think either that provider or that institution might be doing.
Right, and that makes sense. So if you're thankful, you want to kind of donate money. And broadly, why is this an ethical issue?
Well, you can imagine, and both of you are physicians, so... And I should just specify, I'm speaking mostly about physicians right now, but I think this relates to all clinicians. So this can kind of broadly apply to nurse practitioners and physician's assistants and all of the other ranges of clinicians as well. But, you know, my role when I see a patient, my primary role is to determine if anything is wrong, make a diagnosis, and treat them. And so I'm there as their medical doctor. And grateful patient philanthropy, when you're working with a patient in terms of they're interested in giving some type of financial donation to an institution, you're stewarding a financial relationship. So there's a risk of changing that doctor-patient relationship, which is primarily focused on a patient's medical care and always holding that patient's medical care and their primary interest at heart, to now talking about something where the patient has the potential of giving some type of financial donation that could benefit the institution that the physician is working with.
Well, it seems like there are lots of layers here, and we're going to try to be like an onion, and we can peel some of these layers off, because there could be a situation where, you know, patients give gifts to physicians around holidays, birthdays, you know, things like that. It could be as simple as a piece of cake or a sweater, as my mother used to give, or she gave one of her paintings every time she went to a doctor, and she loved her eye doctor.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, and that's one level. But then there are times in which a patient might want to say, you know, I'd really like to give. Like I had a patient not too long ago, so I would love to leave some property to the university. Do you know how I do that? Like, oh, that doesn't get off very often. To me suggesting, how do you see or begin to see differences in different ways of this physician-patient kind of fundraising, gift-giving?
Sure. So I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think they're two very distinct categories. I think the category of personal gifts, whether it's a bottle of wine or a piece of cake, or I actually have gotten some lovely knitted goods from patients over the years. Those are usually, institutions often have personal gift policies, so what things is acceptable or not acceptable to a physician to take from a patient. That's different than in terms of talking about grateful patients who are wanting to give financial donations to an institution on behalf of their positive experience with the physician or to the institution itself because of, you know, their interest in sort of supporting, you know, say they want to do more research in prostate cancer or macular degeneration and wanting to give the institution on that level.
And if they want to give it and it comes from them, that seems different than if you don't know if they do and a physician or representative of the hospital's contacting them. Is there a difference ethically?
I think that there are ethical issues that come up, whether or not it is physician-initiated or patient-initiated. I think it's more common to to talk about when patients initiate and patients express that they have means and they're interested in supporting something, and exactly the scenario you're talking about where somebody says they want to leave a piece of real estate, there's often situations that physicians just are unfamiliar with how to handle such a request and how does that get sort of routed through the institution, and also feeling unfamiliar with how that impacts their relationship with that patient. So there's a host of ethical issues around that, but probably the area that is more ethically contentious is when a physician would actually initiate a conversation with a patient and without having any prompting from the patient and saying, you know, would you be interested in supporting X, Y, or Z?
And do you think this type of fundraising can be done ethically?
I think it can, but I think there's a large caveat, and that's just in terms of making sure that before a physician is making any type of, you know, a physician-initiated request of a patient, I think they have to have a long-standing, close relationship and a familiarity with each other and patient sort of interest in the physician's work and their interest in potentially doing something before approaching the patient. And I think it has to be done in the context of not doing in the midst of a clinical encounter. Say you're coming in for your surgery next week, and it would never be appropriate to say, you know, as you're wheeling somebody back to the operating room, hey, would you be interested in giving to my research initiative? It needs to be done in the right setting, and you need to take great care there, because I think there is the risk of jeopardizing a relationship with that patient and the patient feeling that your interest in them is financial and not for their health.
So. Yeah, and patients are very vulnerable and so many times in the medical encounter and the disparity of power. And we're going to get into that in a second. We're going to need to take a break. But I think when we come back, I'd love to kind of talk about this cornerstone between privacy and power and the ethics and how these things play out well and then what happens when it goes wrong, because there certainly can be those circumstances. But we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we're going to continue talking with ophthalmologist Dr. Megan Collins of the Wilmer Eye Institute and the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins about the ethics of grateful patient fundraising in medicine. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Emily Hanna. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with ophthalmologist Dr. Megan Collins of both the Wilmer Eye Institute and the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins about the ethics of grateful patient fundraising in medicine.
And right before the break, Dr. Collins, we were really starting to dive into some of the issues that could really be kind of the disparities between the patient and the provider in terms of maybe power or vulnerability. What happens when it goes wrong? Maybe talk to us a little bit more about what that looks like and how that can be really damaging to the relationship and maybe even the institution.
Well, I think as you point out, and this was actually sort of the rationale behind us having this summit and coming up with recommendations about how to do grateful patient fundraising in the correct manner, because there are risks of it going wrong and risks of it jeopardizing a patient's trust in a physician or an institution. And there are, if you There's actually literature on this about physicians' comfort level with discussing philanthropy with patients, either initiating it or responding to it. And a lot of times physicians feel very uncomfortable and they don't feel that they've necessarily been given the training or the resources to do it properly. So you can imagine if they haven't been given the training or the resources that there could be situations either of a physician initiating a conversation with a patient in an inappropriate way, meaning that, you know, either during the context of a clinical encounter with a patient that he or she does not have an established relationship with, and just really undermining that patient's faith in that doctor's interest in taking care of them and their health. You can also imagine a situation where a patient would express interest in some type of financial gift to support some type of initiative, and sometimes the physician wouldn't necessarily be the one with expertise in doing the type of thing the patient is interested in. So, for example, as I'm a pediatric ophthalmologist, if somebody said to me, I'd like to give you money to support my interest in studying, you know, heart interventions in kids. Well, I'm certainly not a cardiologist, so it would not be in any way appropriate for me to either say that I couldn't accept that or that I had the knowledge or expertise to be able to fulfill their interest. There can be unrealistic expectations on the part of both patients and physicians and just risks of jeopardizing that relationship that's supposed to be primarily based in patients' medical care.
Now, I have a family member, and her son got sick when he was little, and she felt like the hospital saved his life. So she's very happy, and she still gives money to that hospital. And I was just wondering, how important is that funding to hospitals coming from patients like her?
Thank you for asking, Emily. It's hugely important. I think I quoted in the article from the American Healthcare Philanthropy Institute, they estimated that in 2016, over $10 billion of money to healthcare institutions came from grateful patients or foundations on behalf of grateful patients. So this is a huge benefit to healthcare organizations that grateful patients are helping to support a lot of things in terms of thinking about some early career scientific investigations that may not necessarily be ready to be funded by National Institutes of Health or other entities like that, or, you know, some pilot education programs, some capital expenses for new equipment and new interventions that might be life-saving or life-transforming for patients. So there's a lot of great things that happen for institutions because of the generosity of grateful patients. And there's also a huge interest on the part of grateful patients of actually wanting to contribute meaningfully to an institution. And it, you know, it doesn't need to be somebody who has the capacity of, you know, a millionaire or a billionaire. There are plenty of people who have had a positive experience with an institution and like the idea of giving back and like the idea of supporting that endeavor.
As we think about it, I know that institutions increasingly are dedicating resources to developing programs that help identify and educate both physicians and patients about opportunities. Are there any concerns about privacy with large data mining that institutions may do to identify patients who might have capacity to do that? Is that okay, or are there also concerns, or both?
So you might be talking about, I don't know if you've heard of a term called wealth screening.
Yes, that would be the nickname for it, yes.
So that has received more attention lately, and wealth screening is a process whereby institutions can actually, and this is legally permissible because it's under the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, there are some elements of patient information that is shared with institutional development officers, and institutional development officers can then look patient information up in publicly accessible database. I shouldn't say patient information, but they can look up information about patients in publicly accessible patients and find on that information about a patient capacity to give. While this is something that's legally permissible, I would say for a lot of us, it leaves a sense of uneasiness as to you know, is this the right thing to do? And one of the things that we recommended in our article is that there's got to be a lot of more investigation into this practice in terms of, do patients know that this is happening? So when patients sign their HIPAA waiver when they go in to receive medical care, this is part of the authorization for, you know, release of your information and includes this. But I don't think patients necessarily specifically understand this aspect of their information use. And I think I would like to know more about sort of how patients feel about this. Is this something that's concerning to them?
Yeah, and your paper does call for more research. So other than that, how else would you like to see this issue further studied?
I think there's a lot that we do not know about grateful patient philanthropy and a lot of perspectives that we need to bring to the table. We were struck when we started to put together this summit a few years ago that ultimately the recommendations for the academic medicine paper came out of, and the JAMA paper that Adam is referring to, is that there's just not a lot of literature either in terms of physician perspective, patient perspective, or even the general public perspective about grateful patient philanthropy. And from a patient perspective, if people give, why do they give? If they don't give, why don't they give? How did they feel about being approached? How does a member of the general public feel about the entire kind of topic of grateful patient philanthropy, and specifically those issues around wealth screening? And then in terms of physicians, really understanding physicians who engage in grateful patient philanthropy, what are their feelings about it? What are the ethical issues that they feel it brings up to them? And what are strategies to help allow grateful patient fundraising, which again, I think is an important and useful addition to the mission of healthcare institutions. How can it best be done in a way that is most ethically responsible, keeps the primacy of the doctor-patient relationship around the health and well-being of a patient, and maintains strict privacy and confidentiality for patients, protects those who are vulnerable, and allows meaningful use of those contributions from patients to go forward with the intent that the donors had to support the mission of the institution.
There's so much more to this topic, but I want to ask you just one final question, which is, in disclosure, I do a lot of development work for our institution and volunteer, but one question I think that I try to have providers willing to say is, not in the midst of a patient encounter, but either later on a phone or maybe later at the end of a visit that's not very much about sickness, but to say, you know, there's some really important work happening somewhere, may or may not be related directly to me. Would you be willing to maybe talk with someone at some point in time, not me? Something like that. Is that question an okay one in general?
So I think it's appropriate, but I would not necessarily do that with every single patient. I would have to have that with a patient that I had an established relationship with. I'd feel uncomfortable doing that anytime a new patient would walk into my office. So I think having an established relationship, and as you're pointing out, not in the middle of any type of clinically unstable state of affairs.
And for some reason that you believe that they might be receptive, maybe something they've said to you or something else. Because
yeah,
if it goes wrong, then you've damaged the relationship.
Exactly. I think there's a lot of taking cues from patients, but I think the other thing, Adam, that you said there that's really important is involving somebody else. So these conversations and this, you know, stewarding of a philanthropic relationship should not be done by a physician and a patient in isolation. It really needs to involve the development infrastructure of an institution. And the development officers are the ones who are really trained in how to have these discussions with patients and how to advance them. And it really should not be the physician having these negotiations with a patient in terms of, I think, the contracts that ultimately get signed with institutions and what the institutional tax assessments on gifts are and, you know, timelines of payment and things like that. The relationship between the physician and the patient should continue to be around the health and well-being of the patient. And as the patient is interested in learning about, you know, any of the potential research discoveries or scientific advances that have come because of their support, that's wonderful. But it's involving the development officer into that relationship that I think is critical.
Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Megan Collins, for bringing compassion and concern and a deeper dive into an issue that really affects pretty much everyone within the doctor-patient relationship to your health listeners.
Well, thank you so much for being interested in this topic. So hopefully this will help further discussions around it and improve how we are taking care of our patients.
We've been talking with ophthalmologist Dr. Megan Collins of the Wilmer Eye Institute and the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins about the ethics of grateful patient fundraising in medicine. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Emily Hanna. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Jamila and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. If a listener wants to send us a question or concern, they can send it to yourhealth, one word, at unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question.
I was recently given a medicine for my blood pressure because it was high despite two other medicines. However, after taking this new medicine, my blood pressure actually went up rather than down, and I had problems urinating as well as some heart palpitations. What do you think happened here?
Well, something that wasn't very good and wasn't and wasn't expected either, right? I mean, it's like, okay, I'm going to give you an antibiotic, and you know what? You're going to get better. But then all of a sudden, you don't get better. Like, you have an allergic reaction to the medication. That's happens, and we recognize it. Do you think that happened here, Jamila?
It sounds like rebound, mm-hmm. possibly.
Did they stop another medicine the patient was on to start this new one?
Right.
Or did they just add it? Like, there's some medicines, if you take them off of it, you can get a really rebound high blood pressure medicine called Clonidine. If you stop that suddenly, your blood pressure is going to shoot way up.
Right.
But what if they just added a new medicine? Let's say they gave the patient a diuretic, which should have caused them to pee more and lower their blood pressure, but it didn't. Could it have been a side effect of the medicine?
Maybe that or a paradoxical reaction.
Yeah. Yeah, like it just happened and we don't know.
Right.
We call it idiopathic, which is like dummy word for we don't know. Yeah, you know, there's a whole lot of reactions that occur that are kind of paradoxical. I like that word. It's a paradox, but it happened, and clearly that medicine wasn't the right medicine for you. Whatever we want to say about it, it wasn't the right medicine right. for you. It didn't work. It kind of had some weird things happening there that we don't really want to figure out more because we're going to stop it.
That's a good plan of care.
And we're going to watch your blood pressure, and we're going to see what we can put you on that might be different or better.
Yep.
Yeah. Sound good. And we might put in your chart as an allergy.
Or an intolerance.
Intolerance.
Some type of yes.
Yeah. Don't give this medicine in the future. Weird paradoxes happen.
Yes.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
My spouse had cirrhosis from fatty liver disease for a couple of years. Recently, his doctor said that they saw some areas of the liver that might indicate early cancer. He feels good otherwise. Is this the beginning of the end?
That's always a tough question, and I'm not sure we are in any position to make that type of judgment.
This sounds like a referral.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I certainly don't know the prognosis of that cancer. There's the prognosis depends on the type of cancer.
And how long they've had it.
Yep.
I mean, it may not be moving very quickly. And a lot of times the liver cancer moves very slowly and associated with these things. But it's not a good thing that now a pretty serious disease like cirrhosis is now also a pretty serious disease like cirrhosis plus cancer. That can't be good in the general scheme of things. But, you know, in terms of prognosis and in terms of kind of thinking about things, I do think it can open conversations with the doctor about things like advanced directives, the wishes that you want as you do get sicker.
And palliative care versus hospice even.
Yeah, palliative care is good. It's not hospice, but it allows you to meet with people who specialize in these difficult decisions that look at your values. I think it's a great idea. Referral to palliative care would be super. Mm-hmm. Great idea, Jamila. Laura, what's our next house call?
I went to see a doctor who is not my normal doctor, but I really liked her. My doctor's okay, but this doctor was more compassionate, took more time with me, and I think I'd like to switch. Is that something that I can ask for, and would that be granted?
Oh, okay, Julie, I'm going to let's see what you have to say about this one.
Oh, goodness. It's patient-driven, so I always go with what the patient wants, patient choice, consumer choice. So I certainly don't see why that could not be granted.
Yeah, you know, I'll play the devil's advocate on that other side, which is I know in some clinics, they don't have a lot of doctors, that the doctor switching can create some things because it'll create some situations where one doctor in the practice gets so many more patients than another doctor. And also maybe one, you know, someone says some things about that other doctor. In this case, that's like the other doctor was bad. She's like a doctor better. I think I would sometimes like to encourage to stay with a relationship, but recognize you maybe could have two doctors, right? You have one doctor you see most of the time, but you have this other doctor you could see when you need something and that other doctor's not there. So I say, well, you could get the best of both worlds. Help that other doctor be more compassionate, be more like the doctor you want them to become. Because I think most doctors want to be the best doctor they can, but maybe they don't know how always. And so some feedback. And I want to see one of your colleagues, I really like them. One of the things I really liked about them is they sat and listened, and then they affirmed what I'm doing. Do you think you could do that a little bit more? I don't know how you say that in ways that, but giving that doctor some feedback, that would probably improve your relationship too.
That was a great idea, Adam.
Yeah, we have to sometimes give docs feedback. Don't be scared.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do it with compassion. Because we're humans too, even though that may not be always the way it comes out.
Right.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Send us a note. Tell us what you think. Share it with friends. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our co-host today, Dr. Jamila Battle. Great as usual. And our guest today, Dr. Megan Collins. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Jamila Battle.
And I'm looking forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill. Presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.